So we continue tonight in the 9th chapter of The Life Divine, The Pure Existent. We got almost halfway through it last time. It is one of the fundamental chapters in The Life Divine which calls us to what we will do for the rest of the book. Because to define what is existence defines what is the rest of what we will pursue. The chapter opened, if you'll remember, with a quotation, a motto, as Sri Aurobindo called them, from the Chandogya Upanishad. One indivisible, that is pure existence. Asid ekam eva dityam. One only, without a second. This, of course, captures into beautiful Sanskrit what is a prime experience of a sage in Upanishadic ages. In the first part of this chapter, he's approached what we experience as soon as we gaze out at the world, that there is this enormous energy at play. But it is an infinite existence which has expressed itself as the cosmos. It is that reality which is beyond the modes of time and space, which is exhibiting itself, enjoying itself as this universe. So the world, in a sense, exists for itself. It has its own colossal aims. And we, the ego, think that we're the center of it all, that it is all based upon us, grounded in us. It isn't that the world takes no notice of the individual, but has obviously a cosmicity to it. We, however, are limited in our vision. But that doesn't mean we are irrelevant or unimportant. And the universe also does not think we are unimportant. When we try to see things in terms of quantity, because the universe is vast, we're nothing, we're just a speck, we have no meaning. That is an illusion based upon quantity. But when, on the other hand, we think that only that which has consciousness, which has life, has meaning, and all the rest is without significance, that is an illusion of quality. And all things have, in a sense, to be integrated into the vastness, which is the cosmos. So we seem to be in a position where the ego is working against the world. But we find that when we harmonize ourselves with the cosmos, that we participate in the will that is expressed in the cosmos and find a deeper communion with nature and with that, with that which nature comes from. Because what is this all? To Sri Aurobindo, behind the play of the cosmos is an infinite and indefinable pure being, a sat, sheer pure existence, with which we began, in fact, with the citation that opens this chapter. But reason can also lead us to that. But is reason enough? Reason could, in following the mere phenomenal play that's presented to us in the cosmic changing scenario persuade us that there is no being behind, that only becoming is. Sri Aurobindo refuses to accept that and sees that if we accepted that position, that our climb evolutionarily upwards from matter through life, mind, and beyond to realms of pure spirit would eventuate in nothing. We would get to the top of the step, there'd be nothing more. And when we look back at the staircase, it would be founded upon nothing. He refuses to accept that a void is the basis and the beginning of the cosmos. So he does not accept necessarily then the Buddhistic idea that the shunya is that from which all cosmos springs. But he will say that we can move from this witness position that we have, in which we measure and gauge the universe and regard it in terms of pure reason, to a deeper understanding which goes beyond and behind the mind. And so I think, if you will permit that to be a rough summary of where we were a couple of weeks ago, let's resume with the text from Sri Aurobindo. And I said that we would begin this week with the paragraph, "But all this, it may be said." But I think I'd like to back up and reread that previous paragraph again, because in a way it captures, in a pithy way, all that we're discussing here tonight. Necessarily, when we speak of things passing into that from which they have come, we are using the language of our temporal consciousness and must guard ourselves against its illusions. That idea of things passing into that from which they have come, again, that's directly from the Taittiriya Upanishad. What is that reality from which all things have come, in which all things are sustained, and to which all things pass and they're going hence? That's the quest that the young boy or the young man goes off into deep tapasya to discover. And he finds again and again that there's a different answer. First, it is matter, it is the field of food which is real. But then he contemplates farther and discovers that no, it is prana, it is the life force which is the mother of all things. And then beyond that, there is mind. Mind is not the end. There is a super mind. And beyond that supermind, he finds that the fundamental fount of all things is delight. It is bliss. And then he rests, because that is the final thing. Satchit Ananda, you might say, is there. Because in the experience of sheer bliss is infinite consciousness, is infinite being. So Sri Aurobindo's language in this first sentence harkens back to that. So there's this whole Upanishadic Vedantic position which is summarized right here in this sentence. The emergence, he writes, of the movement from the immutable is an eternal phenomenon, and it is only because we cannot conceive it in that beginningless, endless, ever-new moment which is the eternity of the timeless, that our notions and perceptions are compelled to place it in a temporal eternity of successive duration, to which are attached the ideas of an always recurrent beginning, middle, and end. So we're caught in the momentary flow, and the agency of mind understands by dividing. So there's a past, there's a present, there's a future. But really, what is only is. And one has to grow out of this mental vision of things into what Sri Aurobindo will later call, in his synthesis of yoga, Trikala Drishti, the vision of the three times, where past, present, and future are one, because only that eternal moment really exists. Everything subsists and resides in that. But we'll continue here. But all this, it may be said, is valid only so long as we accept the concepts of pure reason and remain subject to them. But the concepts of reason have no obligatory force. We must judge of existence not by what we mentally conceive, but by what we see to exist. And the purest, freest form of insight into existence as it is shows us nothing but movement. We'll come back to that in a moment, but this idea that what one thinks is one thing, but what one sees is another. This gets to the heart of the entire field of Indian epistemology. Philosophy is founded in India upon not what you think and consider, but upon what you have seen in your inner being. It is called darshan. And Indian philosophies are called darshanas because you have really seen something. You've gone beyond the modalities of mind and found something in the penetralia of existence which is far more important and real. So it is ultimately the yogi who has the great knowledge, not the thinker, not the one who would learn by division, but whose vision is so large that it unites, that all is consumed in the fire of that vision. All divisions disappear. But here he's making a somewhat different point, but the idea that we must see what exists, and its equation with the term darshana is what I wanted to draw your attention to. Two things alone exist: movement in space, movement in time, the former objective, the latter subjective. Extension is real, duration is real, space and time are real. Even if we can go behind extension in space and perceive it as a psychological phenomenon, as an attempt of the mind to make existence manageable by distributing the indivisible whole in a conceptual space, yet we cannot go behind the movement of succession and change in time. For that is the very stuff of our consciousness. We are, and the world is, a movement that continually progresses and increases by the inclusion of all the successions of the past in a present, which represents itself to us as the beginning of all the successions of the future. A beginning, a present that always eludes us because it is not, for it has perished before it is born. What is the eternal, indivisible succession of time, carrying on its stream a progressive movement of consciousness, also indivisible. Duration, then, eternally successive movement and change in time, is the sole absolute. Becoming is the only being. This is not Sri Aurobindo's position, but he makes a compelling argument, doesn't he? There's a footnote. Let's see what it says. Indivisible in the totality of the movement. Each moment of time or consciousness may be considered as separate from its predecessor and successor. Each successive action of energy as a new quantum or new creation. But this does not abrogate continuity, without which there would be no duration of time or coherence of consciousness. A man's steps as he walks or runs or leaps are separate. But there is something that takes the steps and makes the movement continuous. So you see, he's suggesting here that he's going to plump with that which is real, which releases itself in process into time, and not simply that the process moves without any substantive being within it, that all is simply divisible. So this is exceedingly important. So bear that in mind. In reality, he writes, this opposition of actual insight into being to the conceptual fictions of the pure reason is fallacious. If indeed intuition in this matter were really opposed to intelligence, we could not confidently support a merely conceptual reasoning against fundamental insight. But this appeal to intuitive experience is incomplete. So you see the point. If this intuitive flash that all is process, and great philosophies have been founded upon that, were truly deep enough and integrative enough, then we would have to throw aside what the mind tells us. The mind seems to suggest there is a reality from which this process stems. But this flash of intuition, which he's just described above, would argue in the other way. So let me read it again. But this appeal to intuitive experience is incomplete. It is valid only so far as it proceeds, and it errs by stopping short of the integral experience. So long as the intuition fixes itself only upon that which we become, we see ourselves as a continual progression of movement and change in consciousness in the eternal succession of time. We are the river, the flame of the Buddhist illustration. And Heraclitus would pitch in with that as well from Greek philosophy. But there is a supreme experience and supreme intuition by which we go back behind our surface self and find that this becoming, change, succession are only a mode of our being, and that there is that in us which is not involved at all in the becoming. Not only can we have the intuition of this that is stable and eternal in us, not only can we have the glimpse of it in experience behind the veil of continually fleeting becomings, but we can draw back into it and live in it entirely, so affecting an entire change in our external life and in our attitude and in our action upon the movement of the world. So you can see this is where his insight really takes us, that one can have an intuition and an experience that carries you to that which is behind this whole becoming. Remember some chapters back when he was thinking about whether there is a being or is not a being. What is it that gives rise to the universe? And he would accept the idea that non-being could be figured as that, as long as non-being means that which cannot be captured in the positive terms of existence. Because that which ultimately is remains transcendent. Transcendent even of its mode of being, let alone of its expression in the field of becoming. So because what is in you is consonant with what is in the universe, you too can have that experience, and you must have that experience. To get to that deepest part in you, which is real behind the becoming, you are not the phenomena, you're not the changing personality, you are a self which is eternal. But behind that is this reality which cannot be expressed fully in eternity or in time, which is completely transcendent. No category, no thought can gauge what that is. So he's drawing a thread of continuity, of similarity between you and your truth and the cosmos and what is true behind its veil of becoming. And this stability, he writes, in which we can so live is precisely that which the pure reason has already given us, although it can be arrived at without reasoning at all, without knowing previously what it is. It is pure existence, eternal, infinite, indefinable, not affected by the succession of time, not involved in the extension of space, beyond form, quantity, quality, self only, and absolute. This takes us back to the opening citation, doesn't it? Only that one existence. Only that one existence. There are not two. There's only one. We're all part of it. Nice. He continues, the pure existent is then a fact and no mere concept. It is the fundamental reality. But let us hasten to add, the movement, the energy, the becoming are also a fact, also a reality. The supreme intuition and its corresponding experience may correct the other, may go beyond, may suspend, but do not abolish it. We have therefore two fundamental facts of pure existence and of world existence, a fact of being, a fact of becoming. To deny one or the other is easy. To recognize the facts of consciousness and find out their relation is the true and fruitful wisdom. So this is our goal, and his asseveration is that we'll spend the rest of our lives on this if that's what it takes. We must find this unity between true being and cosmic extension, between this apparent personality and the inmost soul, which is one with that one. This next is a paragraph you want to mark in your books, and let me just read it straight through. Stability and movement, we must remember, are only our psychological representations of the absolute, even as our oneness and multitude. The absolute is beyond stability and movement, as it is beyond unity and multiplicity. But it takes its eternal poise in the one and the stable, and whirls round itself infinitely, inconceivably, securely in the moving and multitudinous. World existence is the ecstatic dance of Shiva, which multiplies the body of the god numberlessly to the view. It leaves that white existence precisely where and what it was, ever is, and ever will be. Its sole absolute object is the joy of the dancing. This is the image of Nataraj. Sri Aurobindo's sentence comes close to capturing the beauty of the image. But as we cannot describe or think out the absolute in itself, beyond stability and movement, beyond unity and multitude, nor is that at all our business, we must accept the double fact, admit both Shiva and Kali, and seek to know what is this measureless movement in time and space with regard to that timeless and spaceless pure existence, one and stable, to which measure and measurelessness are inapplicable. We have seen what pure reason, intuition, and experience have to say about pure existence, about sat. What have they to say about force, about movement, about shakti? And the first thing we have to ask ourselves is whether that force is simply force, simply an unintelligent energy of movement, or whether the consciousness which seems to emerge out of it in this material world we live in is not merely one of its phenomenal results, but rather its own true and secret nature. In Vedantic terms, is force simply prakriti, only a movement of action and process? Or is prakriti really power of chit, in its nature, force of creative self-conscience? On this essential problem, all the rest hinges. Is consciousness then the nature of existence? His position is that nature is not inconscient. It is a power of consciousness. And as you will see when you turn the page, the title of the next chapter is Conscious Force. It is not simply a question of chit, sat chit ananda. Chit tells you that existence is conscious of its own delight. But this infinite consciousness is also infinitely potent, powerful. It must be chit shakti, conscious force, which is the nature of true reality. Else, there could be no evolution of delight which throws nature out as an infinite expression of the Supreme's bliss. I mentioned Nataraj. You've probably seen Nataraj, but if we can have a little moment, give me just a second, I'll be right back. This, if you can see it, is Nataraj. It is Nullar Nataraj, comes from South India, and instead of the pure circle, it has this elongated. You can see that that circle of fire represents the circumference of the universe. All the universe is contained in this being. Who is at the center of the being? The Lord. Conscious existent. Not sheer existence, but an existence which has become a being, a conscious person. And you can see that this conscious being is possessed of four arms and hands. In one hand, he has a drum with which he beats out the rhythms of the universe. In another hand, he has a goad with which he pushes you forward, makes you grow, whether you want to or not. Another, he has a fire which both destroys and purifies. And in yet another hand, he holds up his palm in the sign of Maya. Don't fear. Be fearless. And then, with his last hand, points at his foot, saying, come, come to me. Seek refuge at my feet. One foot presses down upon the darkness of ignorance, whose figure is the ego. And the other foot is raised, one in the universe, affecting ultimate good, the other suggesting that it is transcendent and always lifting itself up to go beyond. into what is supreme. And he dances. He dances. But look at the expression on his face. Absolute, imperturbable peace. Sheer bliss. So even while he undertakes this enormous world-creating dance, still he is seated in his soul. He has not budged from that timeless peace, even though he has become all that is in time. And this image of Nataraj, when you look at it, is your own reflection. This is a mirror. This is you. You have these same salient features in your being. You can achieve the same thing. You can live in peace and from joy and be active and dynamic in the world at one and the same time. There is no division. Just as the Supreme has achieved, you are a seed of light. And that same effulgence that is in Shiva is in you. Shiva, by the way, is a word that means pure white. And because white represents the infinite, it means what is auspicious. I thought you would like to see. I'll put this back, and I'll be right back. So, hello.
Hi. Hello. I am joined for you. Joined.
Thank you very much.
Nika.
A pleasure to see you. A pleasure to see you.
Thank you for inviting.
You're,
thank you.
You're most welcome. You're most welcome. So, any questions, or shall we go for our meditation? Very good. Listen, tonight, the 21st of December, is the winter solstice, no? And what would it represent but the return of light? So, we've been speaking about the effulgent light of the Supreme. This is a day that symbolizes its return. So let us take that as our meditative theme with us into the rest of the evening. In other words, shall we grow? Namaste. Jai Ma. Next week, the 10th chapter.